From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our Sky Guys are back with us today to help digest the events of a wild few weeks in space science. Recent astronomy headlines include churning plumes of icy water on Jupiter's moon Europa, a possible Earth-like planet orbiting our closest neighboring star, the explosion of a SpaceX rocket mucking up outer orbit transportation schedules, and yet that same company's founder promoting his efforts to transport humans to Mars. All in all, it's been a lot for many Earthlings to wrap their heads around, but not too much for our Sky Guys. And so this hour, let's hear from you, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our Sky Guys are Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center and coordinator of its NASA Educator Resource Center. Mal, great to see you. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
And also with us, John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. And John, good to see you too. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, and let's start out with Elon Musk, the head of Tesla Motors, known for a lot of projects, including his company SpaceX. And just remind us, John, what is SpaceX?
Well, it's one of his companies that is really in the headlines not only recently, but over the last several years, as he has done amazing things with the commercial space venture, that is launching vehicles into space or at least into orbit outside of NASA. And now even doing looks like it's even going to he's even going to cooperate with NASA in this quest to go to Mars.
This is part of the whole trend, Mal, right, of not just NASA or the European Space Agency or government agencies having a stake in this, but private companies saying, you know, right, let's give it a go.
Absolutely. Elon Musk is a guy who, in my mind, thinks way out of the box. He'll take things a step further than anybody else does. There are a couple of – there's his company, SpaceX, and there's another one called Orbital that is – they're private companies that have been licensed by NASA, hired by NASA, really, to send things to the International Space Station.
Since we don't have the shuttle anymore.
Right. So most of those trips for supply trips to the space station are one-way trips, except for SpaceX. He says, no, 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 we're not only going to send it up there and attach it and you can get your supplies, but you can reload your trash and other experiments in there and we'll bring it back safely to Earth as well.
And that saves money, right? You're not just
wasting.
It
does, because they're reusable, his Dragon spacecraft, as he calls it. But the other innovative thing he did is back to the old Buck Rogers movies, you know, where you see the spacecraft, this big rocket landing backwards on a planet. He's able to do that. He's been able to land it successfully several times now. He had a couple of mishaps. And, of course, we had a mishap that we were going to talk about, a big one on September 1st. But still, he's plowing ahead and is claiming everything that he has on his docket is going to be on schedule.
Well, I do want to talk about that big one for sure, because that was a big deal, Mal. So I'm glad you mentioned it. But just this week, a lot of people watched the big speech Elon Musk gave about how he aims to make humans, in his words, an interplanetary species. Let's hear just a little bit of that. Here, Musk rhetorically asks, why go anywhere?
There are really two fundamental paths. History is going to bifurcate along two directions. One path is we stay on Earth forever, and then there will be some eventual extinction event. I don't have an immediate doomsday prophecy, but eventually history suggests there will be some doomsday event. The alternative is to become a space-faring civilization and a multi-planet species, which I hope you would agree that is the right way to go. Yes?
Okay, so a little awkward there, but you know, hope you think that's the right way to go. And people go, yeah, yeah, yeah. So a space-faring civilization, that's the goal, John.
Well, in a way, other than all the sensationalism, he's right. The Earth has been hit by impacts, and so there's some risk to being a single-planet species. But he's not the first person to use that phrase either. We've long known that with all of our quest to explore and for adventure and for learning, because when we travel to other planets and explore them, we learn not only about those other worlds, but we also learn more about our planet. So eventually, it's going to become necessary for humans to live on more than one planet. And not because it's too crowded here, but eventually we're going to need to do that. And maybe it's not today. Maybe it's not in 50 years or 100 years. But the road, the journey has to start somewhere. And even if he doesn't send people to Mars in 10 years, at least people are now talking seriously about it, and that will advance the cause of not only space exploration, but populating the solar system with humans, maybe Mars, maybe some asteroids to mine them for materials that are rare or difficult to get to on Earth. So these are things that are going to be happening in our short-term future.
Well, I hope it's not soon or today, as you said, John, because I've got some stuff to do after work. But it is interesting. And Mal, going back to what you said earlier, so here he is earlier this week giving this big presentation, a spacefaring civilization. But you mentioned this, Mal, 1st of September, a SpaceX rocket blew up. Now, no one was on it, but it caused a lot of trouble. Here's how the New York Times described it. The explosion of a SpaceX rocket last Thursday will have an impact across the space industry. An Israeli satellite operator's deal to sell itself to a Chinese company is imperiled. Planned launches of communication satellites that support international mobile phone service and digital television are delayed and put in doubt. NASA's cargo deliveries to the International Space Station will probably be disrupted. Here's the New York Times again. Last week's setback and a failed launch last year when a SpaceX rocket carrying a NASA cargo fell apart in flight are raising questions about SpaceX. So is this really an airline that anybody wants to travel to Mars?
I don't know about an airline, but a space line, you mean.
Yeah.
But one of the things that that I saw on the SpaceX website, what they're saying and what other news on the other side of that coin is, yes, anytime a spacecraft blows up like that, it's a disaster. There was a satellite that was being launched on that. And by the way, it was not a launch. It was just a test of the engines that they were doing in preparation for a launch.
It was a
normal testing thing that they had going. And it appears to be related to a refueling that they were doing of the rocket before the test, because it didn't happen at the bottom of the rocket. It happened up toward the top of the rocket. But other than that, Elon Musk says that there are two other facilities. This was at the Air Force space station or launching point, which is just south of NASA's Kennedy Space Center. And they have a dedicated launch pad that they've been using for their SpaceX launches to the space station. But they also have the NASA side at Kennedy of Launch Site 39A, which is the same launch site that launched Apollo 11 and a lot of the Apollos, and the space shuttles launched from there. They are refurbishing that, and they have done a lot of refurbishing. They could launch from there if they need to. They also have a launch site at Vandenberg Air Force Base out on the West Coast, where many rockets are sent for NASA as well. So his feeling is that one way or another, we're going to stick to our schedule. Our next launch will be in November, is what he's aiming for. But he's not sure at this point just what that launch will entail, whether it's a launch for NASA, whether it's a private launch or not.
The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, our Sky Guys are back, helping us untangle a wild few weeks in the world of space science. Right now, we're talking about Elon Musk, head of SpaceX, and his attempts to get humans to Mars quickly, he says, but a recent setback for Mr. Musk with the explosion of a rocket. A little bit later, we'll talk about renewed efforts to communicate with non-Earthlings, extraterrestrial life. I'm not quite sure what I should call it, guys, but we'll get there. But, John, what do you think? I mean, I know you'd love to go to Mars, but would you travel with Elon Musk given the difficulties he's been having?
Well, he has a lot of proving to do, and I would eventually. It's what he said is very inspiring, that The prospects of traveling to Mars, humans traveling to Mars, maybe not me, but people traveling to Mars in as little as 10 to 15, even 20 years is to me astounding and inspiring. And we need that. We need to inspire our young students. We need to inspire ourselves. It's much better to spend money exploring other worlds than it is trying to invent bigger rocks to throw at each other. I'd much rather be doing that, right, than collectively and instead of some of the things that we've decided to do with our money.
The exchange number again for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And guys, first up is Steve in Nottingham. Steve, thanks for calling in. Welcome.
First of all, I want to say good morning to Mel. And I ask you this question every time, so I'll go back to it. Why not go back to the moon? That was one of the great points of my life when we landed there. Why not set up a colony and then use that as a place to go to Mars? I just see that someday I bet that the Chinese are going to land and we're going to say, wait a minute. We'll be there. How come they're there and we're not?
Well, Steve, thanks for calling. And Mel, I think under the second President Bush, there was talk about going back to the moon, establishing a base there, and using that as a place to jump off to head over to Mars.
Right. Well, Steve, I'll say I'm fully in favor of that. I think that makes sense to have a base that's close to home. But we have to go further than that at some point. But it is a good idea. In fact, the only ones I know of right now that are actually planning to go there are the Chinese. They have a very aggressive space program they're working on. They just recently sent up a second space station, and it's in orbit. And next month, they hope to put a couple of taikonauts, as they call them, on board for about a month's tour up there. So at some point, the Chinese have said they want to go to the moon and set up a base there, but they also want to go to Mars. Like everybody else, Mars is the big goal for most places right now because as technology gets better, so does the chances of getting there safely get better as well.
How does being on the moon help, John? I mean, it's not that far away. And if you're planning a mission to Mars from Earth and something goes wrong at the last minute, you've got everything you need here on Earth to fix it. I mean, in a way, I can see some problems with that.
Well, and that's why there's not a fixed goal, short-term fixed goal going to the moon. There are some advantages. One of the advantages of the moon is it's an intermediate way station, a waypoint. You could store fuel there. Getting on and off the moon is relatively simple because its gravity is so much less than the gravity of the Earth. So it's not as big. It doesn't cost as much energy to land and take off from the moon as it does from the Earth. So you could have an assembly area on the moon. But that infrastructure to develop that is costly.
Right. You got to get everything up there. And what if you forget the wrong, the wrench or something?
Well, I mean, that's the thing about having some kind of facilities on the moon. A lot of proponents of this line of thinking say, well, you know, if we're going to expand, let's expand a little bit at a time, and this would give us practice for establishing a base or a colony on Mars. Because a lot of the same things that you employ on the moon could be used on Mars, even though it's quite a drastically different environment. But a lot of the same skills, a lot of the same technology for building a base and living on the moon could be employed on Mars.
Well, Steve, thank you for the call. Again, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Mal, one more question about this SpaceX proposal. Again, we heard that clip from Elon Musk saying, you know, let's go and I'm the guy to help you get there. How is his proposal to get people to Mars different, and he'd probably say better, than other proposals out there?
He has an interesting approach to it. What he wants to do is park fuel. I was just thinking about this when you were talking, John, about a fuel on the moon as a way station or a gas station, if you will.
Yeah.
But
a lunar gas station.
But what Elon Musk wants to do is put some basically rockets filled with fuel into Earth orbit where we can hook up, which I thought was an interesting approach. And the idea was that he would use his reusable main stage rocket And, boy, I'd say there's a lot of risk. Everything has to go just right. But to initially send up a capsule, and by the way, going to Mars, he wants people to go to Mars. A minimum of 100 people on each spaceship.
100 people?
100 people. That's the only way to make it feasible. And that would bring the cost down for those people to go to Mars, because the idea is to set up a colony there.
I see.
To do that, you need to have a lot of fuel that you can bring with you. So you put this fuel in attachable stages, rocket stages, I guess is the best way to do it, to express it. And the main stage of the rocket will send it up into orbit, drop off the capsule with perhaps the people in it. I'm not sure which order this would be. But then that main stage would come back to Earth, land. And while it's sitting there, right after it's landed, he has a big derrick that'll put another capsule on top of that, loaded with fuel, send that up into orbit. So you reuse the same main stage rocket two or three times. And he admitted later in his presentation that it would take several of these trips. The clip he showed for his presentation was one trip and then you're off to Mars. No, that's not so. You got to put
see.
A lot
okay,
of these things.
Because I did watch that. Yeah.
You put all these things in a parking orbit, and then your spacecraft goes up and grabs onto it, and you have your fuel to bring with you to Mars.
Well, it's a pretty slick video, and of how he hopes to do it a little bit differently, as you described, Mal.
Right.
And we put it up on our website too, if folks want to check it out again at nhpr.org/exchange. Here's an email, guys, that just came in from Kyle. He says, how long or when do you think we'll have spacecraft, like in the movies or Star Trek? And I love that question, actually, John, because it's so tantalizing to see these movies and the craft, you know, that they have looks so amazing. What do you think about Kyle's email? Kyle, thank you.
I think I know where his email is coming from. When you look at the next generation of spaceship, this interplanetary transport system that Musk and others are talking about, you say, huh, it kind of looks just like a little bit bigger Apollo command module, and there's only three people in that. Where's the fins? Where's the warp drive? So science fiction and space travel reality are light years apart, because the functionality of the Starship Enterprise is, well, it's for TV, and the technology that is put forth on the television shows is certainly fictional. There is hardly any of the Star Trek technology that you see, that you go gee whiz about, is really, you know, available to us. So when are we going to see spaceships like that? Probably not for a long, long time.
Kyle, thanks for the email. What do you think, Mal? I love Kyle's email. It's a good question. The three of us, we all watch these movies, you know, and we all talk about them.
I think that's why we watch them, isn't it?
Right.
Because it just it boggles the mind. And as John said, it's going to take a long time for us to ever approach that. You have to take these little baby steps. Elon Musk, when he goes to Mars, he's got a Dragon capsule, which is a modified Dragon capsule. Dragon is the capsule that he loads with supplies for the space station, brings those up there, but he's got a modified one that will actually seat 7 astronauts. And at some point, he wants to send that capsule to Mars. But the first event, he claims, is going to be sometime in 2018. He hopes to send a dummy, no people in it,
right,
type
robotic ship
to Mars, just to test the technology and say, yes, I can land this on Mars safely. And by 2024,
not
that far away, which is about 8 years, if I remember my math right, he's going to hopefully send some live astronauts and return them.
Well, 2024.
That's his goal.
That's what's so exciting about all this. But the fact that he's talking about a capsule going to Mars, be careful. Think about that.
Right.
A capsule. What can you do in a capsule?
For 9 months.
It's a long
trip. Because that's how long it takes you to get there.
Right? hey, I think I'll go outside of the studio and stretch my legs. Okay. So you're going to Mars in something as big as this radio studio, which would be very claustrophobic, even with a normal person who wasn't claustrophobic. So there's got to be some expansion. You know the movie The Martian, that spaceship? That's the kind of technology that we're going to need to go to Mars in.
Now, that place right? was very plush and luxurious and plenty of room.
Well, they thought about people, right? There's a lot of big empty space on that spaceship, which will never happen in a NASA spacecraft. But there was an exercise area.
Right.
There was a place that had gravity, right? Did you notice that?
Yes.
Well, they slid down the ladder. Did that strike you as strange? Well, no, because it's a rotating spacecraft, which poses some engineering challenges. But if you have a portion of your spacecraft that simulates Earth gravity, a lot of the long-term stuff that's detrimental to human health and well-being goes away if there's a place in the spaceship that simulates Earth gravity.
Right, and that's been one of the big problems.
That and radiation.
Right, which we have not figured out yet. Let's take another call, gentlemen. And Jess is joining us from Keene. Hi, Jess. Go ahead. You're on the air.
This is actually Jeff.
Jeff, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. For getting up into space, the cost of getting humans up into space is actually one of the most exorbitant problem with the situation. If you can actually get supplies up a lot easier with certain forms of technology, you can actually lift up a lot of different supplies up to such as the space station or up to for building things up into space. And from that is pretty much build it and they will come. I mean, that's the biggest problem with a lot of this stuff is the cost for getting humans into space.
So we just haven't figured out a cost-effective way to do it, Jeff. That's what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that there is a cost-effective way, but we're always very focused on getting passengers up to space when actually getting supplies up to space and being able to build stations or other things is actually a very cheap way. There's a lot of cheap methods to do such.
Right. Okay, Jeff, thank you for calling. What do you think, John?
Well, that's how the space station was built, a little bit at a time, if you recall. Right? If you look up in the sky and you can see the International Space Station pass overhead, we've talked about that on our show before. So the space station is big now, but it didn't used to be big, and it was built a little bit at a time. You know, the space shuttle was always called the pickup truck of the space industry. So a little bit at a time was hauled up there, put together slowly over time. So the space station has evolved, and the space station was really expensive, and it was reusable. So that's what Musk is trying to do, reduce the cost by reusing material so you don't have to do it from scratch every time.
Jeff, thank you for the call. More with our Sky Guys in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's an astronomy update with our Sky Guys. They're helping us unravel what has been a wild few weeks in the world of space science. Our Sky Guys are John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. Also, Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. Let's hear from you this hour, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And guys, I want to turn to another item that caught our eye on the Exchange team this week. We were interested to learn that there's an effort to reissue what's called the Golden Record, put out by Carl Sagan and a bunch of folks in the late 1970s. Mal, what's the Golden Record?
You may remember there was a spacecraft, two spacecrafts actually, called Voyager. And the Voyager spacecraft were launched. There was Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. When you put them down in the hallway, this one will label number 1 and this one will label number 2. And I say that because number 2 was the first one to launch. And Voyager 1 followed it. But John, you can tell me which of those two ended up going outside. One of them is still inside the solar system, I believe.
No, they're both outside.
They're both outside.
Voyager 2 did the grand tour and Voyager 1 did not.
Oh, okay.
Voyager 1 only went to Jupiter and Saturn, and Voyager 2 went to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
Yes.
So Carl Sagan and his buddies put this golden record on these
craft? They knew, Carl Sagan especially, you know, if you have seen any of his writings and heard him on YouTube. You can find a lot. He was a very humanist of a person and wanted to say, if we're going to be sending spacecraft out there, let's do something that would, if anybody happens to come across this spacecraft, some other civilization, let them know that this is who we are. So they came up with the concept of this golden record. It was gold because it has to stand the rigors of space. And even with it, it is actually a record. There is supposedly some sort of phonograph on board or way to actually play this record at an extremely slow speed, slower than the 33, half the speed of a 33 and a third album would have been.
What's an album?
What's an album?
What's a record?
Now you hold it in your hand and say, where do I plug this in?
So these Voyager craft.
On here.
Yeah, go ahead.
What he did is he had stamped on the outside were some images to give an idea of a star, little star chart to indicate where this Voyager came from. Some drawings of male and female humans and other things on there. But on the record itself, there were sounds of what was going on at the time from the Earth.
So in 1977.
From 1977. And so if anybody had, in my mind, I'm saying if somebody actually found this and wanted to play it, that's why they have not contacted us since, because of some of the things that may be on there.
Well,
but we'll see.
Setting aside the idea that, okay, first of all, you know, if there are other intelligent beings out there. Second of all, would they encounter these Voyager spacecraft? Mm-hmm. Third of all, they would look at this thing and figure out that this record and the record player were set up as a means of communication and not something to eat or a weapon or, you know, it's kind of hopeful.
Yeah.
To put it that way.
Yes. Very hopeful. Yes. Hopeful because he knew that eventually
– he being Carl Sagan.
Carl Sagan knew that both these spacecraft would leave the solar system, and they have. So they're only the only two man-made things that have ever exited the solar system proper.
Okay.
So they're now in interstellar space, the space between the stars. And they're not heading toward any particular stars. They're just out there. So if Sagan was reasoning that if they're ever found and discovered, somebody's going to say, hey, what is that way out here in the middle of nowhere, maybe in 1,000 or 100,000 years? They're going to go over, take a closer look, bring it inside their spaceship, look at it and say, wow, what an antique. This must be worth a lot of money. So
I can sell it on eBay.
So, right. So they're going to see that this gold-plated copper record on the side of the spacecraft, and they're going to see that there's some kind of language inscribed on the cover. Well, okay. You know, we're imposing our curiosity on a yet-to-be-discovered alien civilization. But if they have any curiosity that led them to space, they're going to say, hey, let's play it. Let's figure out what this is. Maybe we can learn something. Maybe. And so there's recording of greetings in different languages. There's images encoded on the record. Photographs. There's sounds of Earth. I know that Bach and Chuck Berry are on there.
Well, and again, I had not heard of this until yesterday, and it is an interesting concept. Even if you think, okay, that's crazy, no one's ever going to find it, but it is a nice sort of time capsule of humanity and where we were at in 1977. Our producer Jessica Hunt put together just a sampling of what actually is on this golden record. Let's hear.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet.
En rikedom av solar finnes där. Var sol pulserar där med allt ett slag, i större solars oerhörda sken, och allt är klarhet där, och dagars dag.
Okay, and closing out the golden record from 1977 with some whale song there. So that's pretty cool. So the other reason that this caught our attention was, one, we'd never heard of it. But two, there's a Kickstarter campaign to reissue the Golden Record. I would love, guys, to hear from our listeners what they would put on the 2016 Golden Record if we were going to send another one out there. So go ahead and give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. By the way, Jack sent us a quick email. He says, most Earth people in 2016 wouldn't be able to play a record.
That's true. That's very true.
What would you guys put on the 2016 Golden Record, Mal?
Wow. I'd have to think about that. There's so many things that could go on there. You probably want to update some of the music, I guess, would be the first thing. Maybe I don't know how rap would go, or because that wasn't around at the time. That's an excellent question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Sure,
have to
and
really
I'm throwing
sit
it
down
at you.
And,
you know,
yeah,
last minute.
Yeah. Thanks. Pie in the face. I like it.
John?
New images. I think the music would stand on its own because, you know, 20, 30, 40 years to an extraterrestrial, that's not going to mean much, right? You could put some additional music that's contemporary now, but I'd put new pictures of how the world has changed since the Voyager images were taken from that era. So that's kind of the most visible thing that's changed. I know I'd buy a copy if they reissued it. And there's a book called Murmurs of Earth that Sagan wrote about the story of putting together that record. It's a soft-covered, kind of an odd format book called Murmurs of Earth. I think it's Murmurs of Earth by Sagan. And it's kind of a photographic documentation of the efforts and the trials and tribulations of putting how they selected the voices, you know, a sound of a fetus, heartbeat of a fetus, all these things, who came up with the idea, how they were encoded on the record, how the decision-making process worked, what Sagan had to do to get NASA to put this thing on the spaceship.
Well, John, I was going to say, I'm struck that NASA even said, okay, Carl, because it is kind of a wacky idea.
Sagan was very, very visual. He knew that the key to public understanding of science and support for missions, they had to have cameras. Cameras produce images. So Sagan was really keen on images. And this is a hopeful image of humanity. And it's uplifting to read the book. You should really – it's probably in your library. It's a really good read. Has all the pictures that are encoded on the original record, and you can take a look at those images that if an extraterrestrial can figure out how to play it and has old kind of equipment, you'll see what they'll see of our planet in some distant place and time.
Well, I appreciate Jack's email saying most Earth people in 2016 wouldn't be able to play a record. And it's a lot to assume, a big, big, big if to assume that some extraterrestrial would be able to figure that out. But we've already talked about that. Did you want to jump in, Mal?
Well, I just was thinking that it probably this time it would not be a record at all. It would be a CD.
Well, or an iPod.
Or an iPod.
It's a lot
lighter. Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Send an iPod, right.
Let's take another call, guys. And this is Kent in Antrim. Hi, Kent. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
It's Ken. I'm just thinking Carl Sagan's one of his last statements to the press was he feared that the only way that mankind would be united would be if we were attacked by another species. And it was a really sad statement, but I always think of the book Battlefield Earth by L. Ron Hubbard, which involves the Voyager being taken by a species and seeing the gold record, and that's the most valuable thing in the universe, and following the map back to Earth and destroying us all.
Wow. Okay, yeah. So somebody has actually incorporated this into a book.
Oh, that was part of that. That was the theme for the first Star Trek movie.
Right.
Which was, I think, really bad. But most Trekkies would really...
If you say so yourself.
Well, they would say, oh, don't bring that movie up. But it's a species finds the Voyager spacecraft. So that somebody's already taken that idea and almost destroyed the Earth had it not been the crew of the Enterprise, of course.
Right.
Well, and that's kind of a cool premise, though. What if somebody did find it?
Yeah.
What it comes into, and they capture it, and out in space, they find out that it's been changed, and they call it V'ger, in the movie, and it means, you know, it was changed from Voyager.
I see. Yeah.
So, well, that part of the word got obscured, and you couldn't read it. So,
right.
So the alien was calling it the wrong name. So,
well, speaking of movies, on this idea of communicating with other beings, Carl Sagan's efforts, other movies. There's countless numbers of movies where humans encounter beings from other planets and try to communicate. There's a new one coming out. Okay, so maybe next time we get together, we'll talk about it. Coming out on Veterans Day in November, it's called Arrival. It stars Amy Adams, and she's this very talented linguist. One has to assume the most talented linguist in the world. Sure. And sure enough, aliens come down, and nobody knows how to communicate with them. So they call Amy Adams and say, you have to put on a spacesuit and help us communicate with these beings. Let's hear just a little trailer.
I am human. Their language. We need to make sure that they understand the difference between a weapon and a tool. Language is messy, and sometimes one can be both.
Okay, again, so that's a trailer from a movie about communicating with extraterrestrials. There have been a lot in this genre, and we'll probably talk about that the next time you guys are on the air. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Roger sent us an email to my question about what would we put on that golden record if we were to reissue it today. And then again, there's a Kickstarter campaign to get that going. Roger says, I'd put on a new recording, Lessons Learned in Global Environmental Protection Since the 70s, Images, Data, etc. Roger, thank you very much for that email.
Maybe that's not a really bad idea at all, to show someone who might be watching that we've learned a little bit in 30 yes. years to take care of our planet. Because if there are people out there watching us, they're saying, oh, my goodness, are these people ever going to learn how to take care of their planet? Because they're pretty rare. At least that would show we've learned something.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in with our fall fun drive. So, guys, I want to ask you about some news concerning the asteroid belt. And this is sort of, you know, I don't know what you want to call it. I don't want to call it a junky part of space, Mal, but it's not as exciting and sexy as Mars or Jupiter or all that. John looks upset that I called the asteroid belt kind of junky. But NASA wants to go there. It has a big plan. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But just what's the asteroid belt, Mal? Just remind us why it's important, even if it looks a little bit junky.
I had a third grader once tell me, I know, you know what the asteroid belt is? And I said, no, what is it? He said, it's the way the universe holds its pants up.
Yeah, I think I've heard that before. But yeah.
But anyway, the asteroid belt is actually kind of like almost the broken up fifth planet, I would say, from the sun.
Okay, that's a good way to describe it.
It goes out, it's between, the bulk of it at least, is between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. And we have a spacecraft at one of those. The largest asteroid is one called Ceres. And we have the Dawn spacecraft there now that's been looking at that. But it's just a bunch of rocks. It's not the way you would see it in, say, the Star Wars movies, or, you know, where Han Solo's trying to duck all these things out of the way. There's a lot of space
there. They almost cracked the windshield, yeah.
We have successfully flown spacecraft through the asteroid belt many, many times. Without a scratch.
And you have to go out of your way to find one to take pictures of,
right.
Which we've done, right? We sent the Galileo spacecraft out in the mid-90s to Jupiter, and it purposely had to be flown to get to an asteroid so we could get some close-up pictures of what asteroids really looked like. So if you were on an asteroid, you could not see the nearest asteroid to you. Like Mal said, it's nothing like it's depicted in the movies or even in renditions of what the asteroid belt is, right? Looking, if you're standing on an asteroid big enough to hold you, you couldn't see the nearest one because the asteroid belt, volume-wise, is huge. There are a lot of asteroids there, but the volume of space between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter is enormous, and those asteroids are dispersed within that belt.
That's interesting because I'm thinking of all the puzzles and placemats that my kids had when they were little, and the asteroid belt looks like, you know, if you flew there like Han Solo did, you'd have to worry about cracks in your windshield.
It's busy.
Yeah.
It's busy, right.
But it's not.
But one of the things that I remember hearing at one point was that if you took all of the debris in the asteroid belt, clumped it together to make one object, you would end up with something roughly the size of our moon.
So pretty small, actually.
Pretty small.
Very small.
Okay, so the reason I ask you guys about the asteroid belt is along with Mars, which everybody wants to go to, NASA wants to go to an asteroid and pick up a giant multi-ton boulder and then, John, chuck it into orbit around the moon.
Well,
what's the point?
Well, they have to get it first, right? So they're going to go to the asteroid belt and pick up a space rock, a boulder, and bring it back. And put it in orbit around the moon.
Right? This is robotically.
Robotically, right. Yes. That part of the mission is robotic. And that's not too that's an interesting technology challenge because a lot of those same technologies and skills could be useful in other interplanetary missions. So I think that's NASA's part of this too, is developing other technologies in an interim to getting to Mars. So then they park this big space rock. Now, there's a lot of interesting things in the asteroid belt. You might say it's junky because it's made up of a lot of pieces. But a lot of the asteroid belt is pristine material that hasn't been modified since the formation of the solar system. So if you want to find out what the solar nebula, the cloud of dust and gas that our solar system and sun and planets formed from, you go to the asteroid belt and find things that have remained unchanged for billions of years.
Because it's pure. But here's my quick question for you, John. Why not just bring it back to Earth and study it? Why chuck it into orbit around the moon?
Well, that I don't know. I mean, I would bring it a little bit closer than the moon because the moon is still 3 days away, at least in 2016. It's 3 days away. So they're going to – so that's where the manned mission part of it starts. Once the thing is in orbit around the moon, then you go there and you study it in close detail.
But, all right. Well, more unanswered questions, but we'll do our best in just a moment. More with our Sky Guys coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we check in with our Sky Guys on a variety of topics in space science, including efforts to communicate with other life forms that might be out there. And we've also talked about the private company SpaceX and its big push to bring humans to Mars. You can join us with questions on those topics and others, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And guys, we really should talk about some excitement over moons in our solar system. And Mal Cameron, I'm going to start with you. There was a lot of excitement just recently about churning, possibly exploding plumes of water on Jupiter's moon, Europa. Sounds like a water park down there.
Well, if it is confirmed, there's kind of an iffy thing here, but the chances are that what they found is true, that it looks like water or ice particles coming out of the kind of the southern limb of this moon, Europa, which is always, we've known since Voyager passed by Jupiter. They got some good looks at this moon, and they knew it was covered with ice. And later on, the Galileo space probe, when it was there in the 90s, it took a lot of close-up views of this moon, Europa, and discovered there was these ice chunks on the surface were actually breaking up and rotating in place, a little thing called rafting. And they said the only way that can happen is there must be a liquid underneath that ice. And so we've known after further trials, they've taken lots of close-up views of it and said, okay, we know that there's some signature ingredients that we can sense from the Galileo probe was saying they even found that there's salt water. It's a saltwater ocean. And the assumption is that there's more water on this moon, Europa, which is just about the size of our moon, maybe just slightly smaller. And underneath the surface of this moon of Jupiter, there's about twice as much water than we have on the surface of our Earth.
That's a lot of water.
It's a very deep ocean.
100 kilometers.
How do we even begin to know that, John? I mean, this Europa is so far away. How can we even possibly guess at that?
When the Galileo spacecraft got to Jupiter in 1995, it entered into orbit about Jupiter. It didn't just fly by. So it hung around for 8 years. So in that eight-year period, it did close flybys of many of the Jupiter's moons, including Europa. So like Mal said, they got to do a gravity map of Europa. As the spacecraft approached and sped away from Europa on its approach, in its trajectory, it was orbiting Jupiter, didn't orbit Europa. But when it passed by the moon, they could see how the moon's gravity affected the path of the spacecraft. And from that, they reasoned that, and other evidence as well, that Europa wasn't solid. It had a liquid ocean. So it was evidence since the 1970s. But later images, about a year and a half ago, that Keck telescope on the big island of Hawaii, a large telescope using a spectroscope or a spectrograph, determined what the material that has stained the icy crust of Europa. It's actually brownish yellow. So they actually did a spectral analysis of that and found that it was some kind of magnesium salts, which means it's a saltwater ocean, which means when you have a saltwater ocean, the water doesn't freeze at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. It freezes at a lower temperature. So that would help explain how this subterranean ocean on a moon whose surface temperature is 206 degrees below zero could be liquid.
Well, it's pretty far from the sun. I have a couple sort of Jupiter moon 101 questions for you guys, just to put this into context. So, Mal, how many moons does Jupiter have, first of all?
A total?
Yeah.
Over 60.
Okay. Because I know sometimes
67? 60. Every
once in a while they find another one. Right. So, okay.
But there are four large moons that you can see even with a decent, powerful enough pair of binoculars, you can, but certainly small telescopes will find them. They are the four Galilean moons, which were first discovered, of course, by Galileo back in 1610. And that's what got him into a lot of trouble, that here's these things orbiting another planet and nobody had heard of that before. So anyway, they are named for goddesses and so on. So we have the one nearest to the planet is called Io, which is a volcanic moon. And then we have the next one is Europa. Then there's Ganymede and Callisto are the other moons. And they orbit on a very regular basis.
Around Jupiter.
So as John said, the Galileo spacecraft was looking at that very nicely. And of course, knowing that there's water under the surface of Europa, water would then lead to the conclusion that there possibly could be life. It is the next place after the Earth that is most intriguing to NASA and other scientists around the world to say, hey, there's a place that if we could dig through that ice and get a sample of that water, that would tell us a lot.
Well, that leads to my next question. We learned so much from the Mars rovers, you know, scooting around Mars for years and years, digging up soil samples, sending us back information. How long would it take, John, for a probe to get to Europa?
Well, the New Horizons spacecraft that was launched in 2006 to go to Pluto got to Jupiter in a year.
That doesn't sound too bad, but that was a flyby. I'm talking about, you know, something like Curiosity that actually plunks down the planet. It's got wheels. It roams around. It picks up samples.
It wouldn't take long to get there, but we don't have available the technology to land on Europa and scoot about on Europa, right? So that's a very different thing. Even the Europa mission that's on the books now for NASA and one for the European Space Agency is not going to orbit Europa because of the radiation environment where it orbits Jupiter. Jupiter is this really potent source of radiation for a number of different reasons that you probably don't want to get into now, but it makes Europa a very dangerous place to get. In fact, the Europa mission is not going to be orbiting Europa. It's going to be orbiting Jupiter with close flybys, get in, get out, get away from Europa, out of that radiation area. Now, the thing about Europa, though, now that we've discovered plumes of water, we don't have to land on the moon. We can just fly by. A couple of years ago at our astronomy festival at UNH, we had Caroline Porco, the science imaging team leader for the Cassini mission to Saturn, give a talk. And she said, why do you want to go to Europa? And this is before the plumes were confirmed on Europa. She said, Enceladus, a small moon of Saturn, has these plumes. Hey, all we got to do is fly through them. And that with life detection or organic compound detection, it's a much cheaper, simpler mission than landing, digging through ice, trying to get to a liquid water ocean. Now, Jupiter is half the distance that Saturn is. Now, we've got a source of water being blasted into space due to pressure from within. All we have to do is get to Europa, fly through the plume with a well-equipped spacecraft that can detect organic compounds and maybe even life, right? So that's a much cheaper, simpler mission than having to land and hang around in the radiation environment of
Europa. Okay, but a lot less captivating. In terms of public relations, I mean, people just love going to the NASA website, looking at those rovers, seeing those sort of landscapes through the rover's eyes, if I could put it that way. So I don't know, Mel, what do you think? I mean, is it worth it just from a PR standpoint to try to plunk something down there and scoop up some ice?
Well, yes, in that sense, PR. People want to know, is there life out there off the Earth, or is it just us? Going back to Carl Sagan, I think he said that if we never find life anywhere else in the universe, that would make it even more profound for us, or just as profound as finding life. But people want to know. But scientists want to know. It gives us more insights into the whole solar system and the universe itself as to how it was formed. And to find water and to be able to analyze it would be one big step forward.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in with our fall fun drive. So just to finish up with you guys, a couple more questions. Mal Cameron, it's goodbye this week to the Rosetta spacecraft. What is that, and
yes,
why goodbye?
Rosetta has been following a comet for – we've talked about this on a previous program and how exciting this was. It's a European Space Agency mission in conjunction with the Russians, and it's been orbiting a comet that has this long name that I can't pronounce. But it has been there orbiting it for a couple of years now. It's called 67P. And, John, can you say those other
names?
No,
I can't.
No, okay. You were looking like you were ready to.
No, so I wrote a P next
67P.
To
67P. Okay. But it's been – it's a marvelous achievement. Here's this comet hurtling through space, ready to go around the sun. And it got there. It orbited it. It sent a small capsule probe to the surface of the comet, which unfortunately landed in a wrong position, and it couldn't communicate as well. It was a probe called Philae.
Speaking of, you know, plunking yourself down and digging around. Yeah.
So now what it's done is it has been following this comet as it goes around the sun, and it's now exiting the solar system. And tomorrow, September 30 in the morning, you can go online and look under ESA's website and find the information about Rosetta, and they're going to be counting down its demise as it lands also on the comet and ceases its mission.
All right. Well, RIP, right?
RIP, Rosetta.
Right. Well, and John, we'd be remiss if we didn't get an exoplanet update from you. Now, exoplanets, again, these are planets detected orbiting stars outside our solar system. I say detected, not discovered, because they're detected through a mathematical formula. In the past few decades, thousands have been detected, but there was one detected just recently, John, got scientists super excited. How come?
Well, a lot of the exoplanets, and so far we've discovered and confirmed, I should say, not just detected, but confirmed 3,532
okay,
planets.
Okay, that's a lot.
Yes, in 2,649 systems. So that means that we know of, for sure, 2,649 other solar systems in the galaxy. And most of those stars that have those planets orbiting them are pretty far away, 50 light years, 100 light years, 200, 1,000, 2,000 light years. Little chance of us ever communicating with anything that might be living there. However, what really was the big game changer recently was that a team of European scientists using the European Southern Observatory. It's like a 3.6-meter telescope. That's how big it is in diameter. Detected a planet orbiting a star in the Alpha Centauri system called Proxima Centauri. Alpha Centauri is a triple star system, two stars like the sun orbiting each other, and a distant small red dwarf, cool small planet star orbiting the pair. Now they've discovered a planet orbiting Proxima Centauri, which is about a tenth of a light year closer to the Earth than the two Alpha Centauri A and B stars.
So our closest neighboring star system has a planet that seemed kind of rocky and kind of like home?
Well, it's rocky, and we don't know if it has an atmosphere, but it's in the habitable zone, the zone around Proxima B, that could support water in the liquid form if it were there.
Well, that's intriguing, and we'll close it out there. Maybe we'll have more information next time we get together. So much fun, guys. Thank you so much for being here. Mal, good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
John, thank you also. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.